You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin.
You know, Setting the Record Straight, which I have to regard as a mission, just as this radio station is a mission, in the marketplace of ideas of today, which is in the media, which is devoted to reawaken our awareness of history. Actually, the internet is the marketplace of ideas of today. The change in the amount of time that a person spends consuming the media has declined in every area except one area. Even our beloved real-life radio is a part of the radio media. The consumption of radio media as a whole is down 15%. The consumption of every other form of media is down at greater percentages than 15%. What's up? One thing. RealLifeRadio.com is a member of the internet media, webcasting. The use of the internet as a whole as a source of media consumption is up 105% over the same period, which is the last 5 years. You know what Setting the Record Straight is? It's historical apologetics conveyed over the internet in the webcasting media. RealLifeRadio.com. Where all of us, me included, need to know more about history to understand ourselves. Because you can't ignore history. It's not even over. You're living in it. You think you can ignore the past? You're living with one foot in it, my friend, and the other foot in the unknown future. As we sail along in life, you are standing in a cursor, a tiny little momentary cursor, the present instant that moves through the text of your life, that moves through the text of your life. That tiny little cursor is called the present. We can learn so much from the vastness of the past because it's not even past. How can you calculate a course toward the future unless you know the point of origin of where you're coming from, where you're sailing from? You can't ignore the past. It's not even past. We're going to talk about the period just after the French Revolution when there was a great Catholic revival in France. Let's set the stage by doing a miniature thumbnail sketch on what the French Revolution was all about. You can regard the French Revolution as the direct grandchild of the Protestant Revolt, the Protestant Reformation or Deformation, in that it enthroned man's reason. It was the age of reason, enthroned man's thinking above God's thinking, above the guidance of Christ carried to us through the vessel of the Catholic Church. The foundation and thought and impetus of the Catholic Church is that of Christ. We will confuse people if we don't state this boldly, state it clearly. It is the vehicle that carries forth God's will, directly carries forth God's will. So today's consideration, based on this foundation, is about the effect this had in the 1700s. This has always been a threat to secular rulers, that there was another allegiance their people possessed in their hearts, a greater allegiance. They may render to Caesar those things that were Caesar's, but they were rendering to God the things that were God's. Now, any secular ruler who combined a hunger for power with perception and intelligence would realize this. Realize this very clear assertion. Realize that everything was God's. If smart enough, they might realize that everything was God's, including Caesar himself, belonged to God. When they looked into the eyes and hearts of the people they ruled, what they saw was a conviction, where that the rank that they really possessed was not the rank of a commanding general, but that of a middle-level officer, perhaps a lieutenant colonel or a captain in the affairs of man. They must submit to a higher power. If they were not persons of principle, you can imagine what their reaction to this realization was. They've never liked this. There's always in every century been a resistance and a war on the papacy and on the Catholic Church as an independent global international organization, which has captured the heart's allegiance of all their subjects, whose greatest allegiance is to Christ himself, therefore to God, and the principles and rules and commandments of God's are taken by this Catholic Church, this global church, this universal church, as their mission to spread these voluntarily to every people and to every human soul, saving them from an unfortunate destiny in the next life. Could anything be in more opposition to the view of secular governments? There's been many periods of temporary peace between secular governments and the Catholic Church, The one that we've enjoyed in this country seems to be eroding. That peace seems to be eroding. Inevitably, we're coming into conflict. So it's worth examining some of the history of this old conflict. So let's ask, how's that been working out in the past? Which is not even over. To put it casually, you wanted complete power, how's that been working out for you? What's the state of your people under your secular power? Look around and examine the life of the generations just before ours. And let's compare it to present conditions. And I think you'll see a great decomposition is in effect. A great decay is in effect. Concurrently, in alignment, and causatively, as a result of less faith in the Catholic Church. Because that is less faith in Christ, who created the Catholic Church specifically to carry his wisdom and spirit forward. Well, let's go back to the time of the American Revolution. Over in France, something similar, but not the same, was going forth. It was animated by atheism and the age of reason, by belief in the supremacy of man's rationality. Fatal error. The media of that time, the public square, the oratory, the books, most especially the arts, never underestimate the power of the arts. They create the rest of the culture, how we think, how we feel, how we love. So the French people have been propagandized. They've been de-Christianized, de-Catholicized, de-evangelized. The media, even then, had great power. The arts, the plays, the novels. They all had attacked the Catholic Church. And the people had been prepared, having forgotten their heritage. The people of France were ready for the Great Revolution, whose purpose, if it had a purpose at all, was not the reform of the ancient regime, but its destruction. I said the people were ready for it. More accurately, they'd been made ready for it on purpose by subversive forces. The parallels to the matrix that we live in today are strong. They're striking. You can't help but notice it. When we have a dispirited populace, it is spirited Catholic populace in this country and in Europe. But what was happening in France in the 1700s and the ludicrously entitled Age of Reason? What was happening back then? Well, we had the seductive democratic theories of Jean-Jacques Rousseau and his concept of the noble savage and the depraved civilized man. Other forces were absolutism, pre-thought, infidelity, licentiousness, the sneers of great writers and artists like Voltaire. All this had done its work in the people's minds and hearts. There was a blind, irresistible wave of force that acted with all the power of a furious element let loose. And it overthrew society from top to the bottom, uprooting everything in the matter of a tornado, leaving the countryside strewn with ruins wherever it had passed. You think this is an exaggeration? It's not. You think this is too colorful a language? Oh, friends, it's not. It's not. It's what's happened to us with the dissolution of our families. In other words, with the decomposition of the basic building blocks of our culture. That basic building block is the family, the intact family. But today we're only thinking about one aspect of the gigantic catastrophe that the French Revolution was that we're concerned with here, with the change it wrought in the Catholic Church. Now let me present some real history. Let's set some of the record straight. You hear there was great antagonism to the Catholic Church among the people on the eve of the Revolution. Not so. There was no real hatred toward the Catholic Church on the eve of the Revolution. That's been overplayed. In a few isolated incidences, yes. The lower classes in France loved the Catholic Church. Now, the higher clergy were not popular. They all belonged to the nobility, and that was their problem. They were attached to the court, mostly absent from their bishoprics and monasteries, worldly-minded and completely out of touch with the common people. The inferior clergy, on the other hand, enjoyed the respect and confidence of the people. There was a lot of economic difficulties. Many of them were poor. And this poverty was fully shared by the clergy. When the assembly of the three orders of the kingdoms, the clergy, the nobility, and the commonality, you hear it called the three estates, the clergy, the nobility, and the common people. In more modern times, we have added something called the fourth estate, the journalists. But let's go back to France. There were three estates, three elements in society, the clergy, the nobility, and the common people. So, The representatives of these groups met at Versailles on May 5, 1789. They were meeting for the first time in 27 years. The lower clergy united, made common cause with the Third Estate, the common people, the commonality, and formed with them the controlling factor in the Constituent Assembly. They had met for the purpose of forming a new constitution. During this famous night session occurred at night, the clergy and nobility were very generous. They sacrificed all their ancient privileges, hoping that that would benefit everyone in the whole nation. It was a generous act with an unfortunate side. The church was thus placed at the mercy of the National Assembly, and it proved no very tender mercy. In order to alleviate the financial distress of the state of the National Assembly, the Assembly decreed in 1789 the confiscation of all the immovable property of the church, assuming in return for this the obligation of supporting the church and the clergy from the public funds. The clergy had thus become at one stroke the paid servants of the state. Seemed like a good idea to people going in, not after it was implemented. Nor did the Assembly stop there. In the following year, the monasteries, convents, and other religious houses were suppressed, and all the church property was placed under the control of the state. So now we've set the stage.
For what happened next? Well, perhaps you know what happened next. But it's good to know how the stage was set for what did happen next. It's BreadboxMedia.com, and I'm Chuck Coughlin, setting the record straight about how the Catholic Church survived the crazy, crazy 1700s. I'll be right back.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at BreadboxMedia.com.
You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight.
We're all together again. Chuck Coughlin, Setting the Record Straight. We're talking about the preamble, setting the stage for the revolution in France and for the Catholic survival and revival afterwards. So in our time travel boots, let's go to 1790 in France and consider Gallicanism. You know, the Gauls are the French, the Gallicanism. It means the French government wanted to rule over the church. That's pretty simple, Gallicanism. Okay, our time travel boots have taken us to 1790. Well, that's when Gallicanism celebrated its greatest triumph. It was entitled A Civil Constitution of the Clergy, unquote. This act was passed by the Assembly. 51 of the 154 bishoprics were suppressed, leaving one bishopric for each of the 83 departments into which France had been divided. All French citizens, including Protestants and Jews, were given the right to choose the bishops and the pastors. Every ecclesiastical officer not directly connected with the care of the souls was abolished. Every priest and bishop was obliged to take an oath on the new constitution. Only four of the bishops, there were some names among them you may know, Talleyrand, Bishop of Autun, and about half the clergy took the oath. Those who refused to vote were removed from office. When Pope Pius VI condemned the constitution, suspended the priests and bishops who had taken the oath, declared elections to ecclesiastical offices invalid, many priests did retract their oaths. They did not want to see a democratic election of bishops and of priests, for goodness sakes. Thus, a disastrous schism occurred in France. The legislature banished all the priests who refused to take the oath. Priests were deported to French Guiana in South America. Basically a death sentence. 380 priests, as a matter of fact.
Few survived the murderous climate. Thousands emigrated to England and Germany. And some even found refuge in the United States.
Though there was plenty of anti-Catholicism in the United States at that time, it wasn't nearly at the level it was in France.
King Louis XVI accepted the civil constitution of the clergy, but refused to sanction the oath necessary to enforce it. He wouldn't give up this point. He wouldn't budge. He refused to sanction the oath. So his monarchy fell August 1792. And September, the next month, witnessed something called the Reign of Terror, in capital letters. The Reign of Terror. They rolled out the guillotines. 215 priests were guillotined. A number of bishops.
the Christian religion was forbidden. The Gregorian calendar even was replaced by a revolutionary one. Keep in mind that today, every nation, including communist China, is on the Gregorian calendar. It is the world standard calendar. Well, back in the 1700s, they were fighting that because it was the invention of the Catholic Church and Pope Gregory the Great. The new era beginning on September 22, 1792, a week of 10 days was introduced, the Decade, the 10th day, taking the place of Sunday. Republican holidays, feasts of labor, feasts of genius, feasts of good deed, took the place of holy days in the church. This orgy of blasphemy was crowned by placing a girl of ill repute on the altar of Notre Dame in Paris. And the crowds came in to worship her, this prostitute, as the goddess of reason. And at least in my humble opinion, that fits. After a few months, this horror came to an end. Robespierre, one of the bloodthirstiest of the revolutionaries, was a deist. And on his motion, the convention decreed that the future religion of France should be deism, with belief, vague supernatural being, and in the immortality of the soul as one of its fundamental tenets. Robespierre solemnly celebrated the feast of the supreme being. A month later, he was overthrown, and he was guillotined. So after that, the church was separated from the state. And then what do you think happened? Freedom of worship was proclaimed again. But after a short while, they took up persecuting Catholics again. Again, hundreds of priests were exiled to French Guiana to certain death. Because Pope Pius VI had sided with the Allies in their war against the French Republic. So then Napoleon invaded the Papal State, invaded Rome. The Pope was forced to sign a treaty by which he surrendered large portions of his territory to the French government. The Pope also had to give over many priceless manuscripts and priceless works of art to Napoleon. Over in Rome, there was an unfortunate incident, just an insignificant incident, in a way. A Frenchman was murdered, so the French took this as an excuse for occupying Rome and putting an end to the papal temporal power. The aged Pope himself was carried off into exile and died in 1799. The enemies of the church rejoiced. The last pope, they declared, had reigned. They claim there would be no more popes. You hear this through history. To the enemies of the church, it's a delicious thought. They were, as usual, wrong. Under the protection of the German emperor, Francis II, the cardinals met in conclave on the island of San Giorgio, near Venice, and elected Pius VII. So you can see how things are going, ping-ponging back and forth from one madness to the other, but the church holding on to the ship of Peter sailing through the hurricane. I said a moment ago that Louis XVI had refused to accept that part of the Constitution which put the church under the state, and this refusal, of course, cost him his life and the throne. The church had also refused this degrading slavery, and though being hunted down and persecuted, had remained in hiding in villages and towns in the countryside. It got worse. The bishops had to flee to other countries. Yet, the Catholic faith was still enshrined in the hearts of the people. That was enough. Napoleon realized this and resolved to make a peace with the church. So he decided to make a concordat with the Pope, an agreement. The most important provisions of this famous agreement were these: the free exercise of the Catholic religion as the majority religion of the French people. Practice of Catholicism would be guaranteed. The teaching of religion was to be free from state interference. The Pope did have to grant the right of nominating bishops to the state. However, reserved to the church and to himself the right of investing them of canonical institution. So this gave him veto power. All the church property confiscated during the revolution was allowed to remain in the hands of the state or of the private individuals who had acquired it. By way of compensation, the state engages to give bishops and pastors suitable salaries, and bishops and the clergy had to take an oath of allegiance. So you see, the church in this agreement had to give up quite a bit of ground. At least there would be enough freedom so that the people could practice Catholicism and take the sacrament. Napoleon declared himself as emperor, set up a French empire, 1804. Let's talk about the character of Napoleon. He'd been educated as a soldier, served the Republic as a gifted young artillery officer. He was assigned abroad to conquer for the Revolutionary Republic. first in Italy and then on adventures far afield. Killing French Catholics, though convenient stepping stone to command, was unworthy of him. Killing France's foreign enemies and expanding her glory, this he did with relish. He was that profound Western phenomenon, a man of action who was also a man of intellect. That was an integral prowess fast disappearing under the anti-intellectual, anti-historical, and anti-integral aftershocks of the Reformation of the Protestants. This Corsican lawgiver who gave the continent the Napoleonic Code was said to be Cesare Borgia with twice the brains and Machiavelli with half the caution and 100 times the will. He was an Italian made skeptical by Voltaire and sharp by the daily duel of French intellectuals. All the fine qualities of Renaissance Italy appeared in Napoleon. In other words, despite being a skeptical Catholic, he was a product of the Catholic culture. He saw his foray into Egypt as a continuation of the Crusades. He studied Islam to appreciate the religion of those he expected to be his subjects. It is a characteristic of Catholic conquerors in history, whether Roman, French, or Spanish, that they respect and absorb native beliefs and customs. Their flexible philosophical minds do not, in the Protestant evangelical way, completely reject or seek to obliterate foreign cultures, but they attempt to understand them and to redirect them, and indeed to subsume into the fabric of Catholic culture their rituals. He was a deist, actually. Nevertheless, he was a Catholic by blood, and perhaps on his deathbed like that of the other conquering thunderer, Frederick II. Maybe he was a true Catholic at last, for he took the final sacraments. But like George Washington, he thought that religion was fundamental to society. That didn't mean he believed in it, but he thought the French Revolution was stupid to think that people could do without the consolations and restraints of their established religious faith. He knew that wasn't true. All of history argued against that. Religion was the friend of law and order. Irreligion was the gateway to crime and disorder. That's what Napoleon thought. He was right about that. What did he think of religious women? Well, I'll quote him. But while I quote it, I completely reject it, of course. Here's what he said. What we ask of education is not that girls should think, he said, but that they should believe. The weakness of women's brains, the instability of their ideas, their need for perpetual resignation. All this can be met only by religion. I want our institutions to produce not women of charm, but women of virtue. They must be attractive because they have high principles and warm hearts, not because they're witty or amusing. It is ironic that Napoleon, viewed in his own time as a radical, was in fact a monarchist, who believed in one God, one church, one pope, one emperor, and the solidarity of subordinate kings and princes. He was a radical in the sense that he swept away the ancient Holy Roman Empire and reorganized French-conquered Europe on an orderly, rationalist Enlightenment scheme that was impatient with all the petty duchies and idiosyncrasies of the ancient regime.
Basically, his vision was colored by having grown up in a Catholic matrix. He did believe that every man blessed with determination, talent, and maybe luck could succeed. If you reflect upon it a bit, you realize that it was indeed a sham that such a man succumbed to man's greatest flaw, pride, the sin of Adam, egotism. Well, why don't we take a break and talk a bit more about that later? This is Breadbox Media, and it's Chuck Coughlin, setting the record straight.
Redbox Media, now is a great way for you to go deeper with your favorite show or shows in our programming lineup. With our Friend of the Show opportunity, you get extra exclusive content from your favorite show hosts and lots of extra love from the shows and hosts you love. Become a friend of the show by clicking on the link on our website or app menu. Your $10 monthly premium membership will unlock an exclusive world just for you. Support your favorite show today as a friend of the show. Friend of the Show premium memberships exclusively for you with Redbox Media.
You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin.
You know, we've been talking about Napoleon toward the end of his life when he had declared himself emperor. But let's step back a moment. Why had there been a French Revolution? Why did that happen? The French Revolution had promised a stable government, sound finance, wise laws, peace, and domestic order. The people had received anarchy, bankruptcy, communism, war, and terror. Many evils did exist in France and 18th century Europe. They accumulated till they were like a pile of dynamite. The torch igniting the dynamite was liberalism, the beliefs that no authority, no responsibility exists, that men owe nothing to God, that man's mind is supreme, the triumph of reason. These ideas were born in the Renaissance and in the Protestant revolt. They grew up in the 17th century and reached a full, terrible adulthood in the 18th century when they spread suffering and death throughout Europe. And we live with this terror today. And certainly the 20th century had greater horrors resulting from the same atheistic or agnostic philosophy. The character of Napoleon is very interesting. He's a symbol for egotism, isn't he? This little 5'4" man with his hand inserted into his vest, having his portrait painting. Napoleon had restored order in France after the Revolution. He shared the revolutionary ideology, however, and would proceed to spread revolutionary liberalism throughout Europe. The evils unleashed by the French Revolution would plague the world to this day. Both Nazism and communism are the children of the Age of Reason, the children of the French Revolution. Now, a person has a right to ask, what would the church offer as a substitute for the Age of Reason? Well, the Catholic Church is aligned with eternity. Therefore, it's aligned with reality, the actual reality. So what we needed was not an Age of Reason. What we needed then and what we need now is the Age of Reality, which is an age that is in touch with eternity and aligned with it. All these other alternatives are other systems of government. They're based on the idea that government owes nothing to God and that moral principles are chains to be crushed into dust. I give you an example of abortion, which was illegal in Europe from the year 410 on as a result of Constantine's conversion to Catholicism, the Roman emperor at the time, and the subsequent spreading of the Catholic ethic and the realization that our souls are all on loan from God. They were all God's children. Wherever today men and governments reject God's authority, his greater authority than governmental authority, and deny the necessity for applying morality to the social and political order, they are continuing the work of the vandals of the French Revolution. I'm leading up to considering the magnificent Catholic revival that occurred after the secular madness of the French Revolution, and also, most importantly, the defeat of Napoleon. At a time when the American Revolution was based on rights from God, the French Revolution was based on rights from man, and therefore those rights could be reinterpreted anytime anybody wanted. Indeed, as we've seen, our right to life could be reinterpreted either by majority vote or by the will by appointed judges who comprise the Supreme Court. Now, the Supreme Court is a body that was originally intended to have an inhibiting effect on the tyranny of the majority, which history again has demonstrated to tend toward the imperfections that are inherent in man. The more you study history, you really come to the conclusion there is no perfect form of government. And therein lies a fatal flaw in what came after the French Revolution and its successive waves of terror, with those destructive forces that had just taken over being destroyed themselves by other forces, which were then destroyed in a wave, after wave of counter-destructions. The counter to the madness of the French Revolution was Napoleon, of course. But he proved to be another kind of madness, didn't he? France had wanted to get rid of their monarchy, of their royal family. And they went through all these years of inhuman terrors and came out on the other end with the restoration of the monarchy. But during that period of successive revolution and madness, they sought a solution. And the solution to it that restored order was Napoleon, who entered first as a hero to bring stability and order. But now we come to my main point, which is with Christ at its heart, the Catholic Church, will always inevitably be led by him as its good shepherd and spring back. Let's talk about that Catholic revival for the few moments we have left. The loss of order and the anti-Catholic spirit had occurred all over Europe. With the Reformation, it occurred in Germany, it occurred in Italy, it occurred in England. Yet there was a Catholic revival after that. The Catholic Church has always tried to have peaceful relations with secular leaders, but they always have the power of excommunication, of denying the sacraments. To people that do not understand the sacraments, that might seem like a light punishment, but it's not. Its effect can be devastating, and the withdrawal of grace can have devastating consequences on earth. Consider this. After Napoleon was excommunicated by Pope Pius VII, 1809, when that happened, Napoleon said, "Does the Pope think that the weapons will fall from the hands of my soldiers because of his excommunication?" Well, that did happen. A few years later, an army report from the icy plains of Russia, which Napoleon's egotistical overreach had led him to invade. The report read, "The weapons are falling from the hands of our soldiers. They were dying of the frost. They were dying of frostbite. An immensely cold winter had descended on Napoleon's invaded army." The army report read, "The weapons are falling from the hands of our soldiers." So Napoleon was forced to a disgraceful retreat from Moscow, years 1812. 2 years later, he was completely beaten by the Allies. In the same castle of Fontainebleau, in which he had kept the Pope a prisoner, the Emperor of the French had to sign his own abdication. Pius VII had, in the meantime, returned to Rome, accompanied by the magnificent processions and rejoicing of the Roman people. After the fall of Napoleon, Austria, Prussia, and Russia formed something called the Holy Alliance. The treaty was distinctly religious in character and stated the sovereigns bound themselves to administer the affair of Europe in a Catholic spirit. Most of the kings of Europe joined the Holy Alliance, which revived the conception of a centralized Europe and a common European responsibility. You might consider this a Catholic European Union. This Holy Alliance recognized the truth so loudly proclaimed by the Church at all times, that the principles of Christ should be applied to politics. There are no issues that are non-theological. I've heard recently criticisms of Pope Francis in the press and in comment threads on the internet, saying that he should keep quiet about secular matters. Well, there are no secular matters. Everything is a theological matter. Well, the Holy Alliance understood that. Unfortunately, it was a short-lived experiment. It was replaced by the growth of purely political alliances. So, gradually, it was superseded. But there were some good effects. In the next few years at the Congress of Vienna, 1814, the states of the Church were restored almost in their entirety. But the property of the Catholic Church, which by these various regimes had been confiscated, stolen, was never restored to the Church. During the years that followed all this, Pope Pius VII entered into agreements with various European states by which the states guaranteed to contribute annual sums toward the support of the Church. In truth, this was meant as reparations for all the stolen real estate. So much real estate that it would make several countries. And unfortunately, the Church gave away too much here. The secular governments received in return the rather far-reaching rights in regard to the nomination of bishops and pastors. But you had to understand where the starting line in these negotiations were. You had a Church stripped of all its ability to exercise temporal power. One of Pius VII's first official acts after his eventual return to Rome was to restore the Jesuits, the Society of Jesus, as well as the national colleges at Rome. Gradually, one by one, the hundreds of vacancies throughout Catholicdom were filled with worthy incumbents. Everywhere there was a marked reawakening of Catholic life. Now, Pius VII attempted to negotiate a new concordat, a new agreement with France, after the restoration of the royal family, the Bourbons. But the Bourbons, who had learned nothing and forgotten nothing, were still wedded to Gallicanism, the control of the Church by the state. They attempted it and failed. There were a few benefits. The number of bishoprics was increased, a sum of money was voted for the support of the church, and the right of the Catholic Church to own property was recognized. Now you might ask, how did the Catholic Church come into the possession of all this property? I've noted at other times that a fifth of the land area of England was owned by the Catholic Church and the monasteries especially, before Henry VIII, who stole every bit of it from them. Well, they owned it because they settled it when it was nothing but rough, unusable land. The monks arrived in the year 600. These future kings were not even dreamed of when they arrived there and began to arduously and laboriously work the land.
And through many centuries of hard, unpaid labor, designed, laid out, and developed the beautiful English pastoral countryside. This beauty is so often praised, but it's seldom acknowledged that it's due to the labor of monks for 1,100 years, at the time that Henry VIII stole the land from the monks and the nuns. The Catholic Church had owned much of that property and worked it for 11 centuries. The Catholic Church, cultivated by His divine hands, will survive. So once again on Breadbox Media, this is Chuck Coughlin, bringing the record to light, setting the record straight. This is BreadboxMedia.com.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at BreadboxMedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
We're all together again. Chuck Coughlin, setting the record straight. We were considering the French Revolution suppression of the Catholic Church and leading up to the great Catholic revival after that. Intervening, though, was the reign of Emperor Napoleon, in which the Catholic Church was forced into a peculiar relationship with an emperor. Wherever today men and governments reject God's authority, His greater authority than governmental authority, and deny the necessity for applying morality to the social and political order, they are continuing the work of the French Revolution. Let's return to the subject of Napoleon. In a way, he was crazier than all the people who had imagined there at Napoleon. Of course, if Napoleon's famous for anything, it's for his ego. He's an egotist. You know, when someone is so pompous and egotistical, they do some very funny things, if you can find it in yourself to laugh at them. They're sort of funny, and they're sort of not. So I'm going to share one with you about Napoleon. I'm going to read something to you that Napoleon wrote, and I have to confess I find it deliciously funny. But it illustrates the egotism of Napoleon once he had declared himself absolute emperor and began his overreach. He could have been king. He could have been just the head of a government. But he insisted on being absolute emperor. This meant reaching into the hearts and souls of everyone and ruling the church. And one thing he did was modify the French catechism. He made his own additions to it. Well, you hear this. After his coronation as Emperor of the French, this is 1804, and his victories over Russia and Austria, which brought about the forced abdication of Francis as Emperor of Germany, a man who was a Catholic, Napoleon's ambition grew beyond all bounds. It was at this time he made the additions to the French Catholic Catechism, which declared that it was the sacred duty of every subject of the emperor to take part in his wars, and that opposition to his wishes was a sin deserving eternal damnation. You think I'm kidding? Just wait. So you know how the catechism has questions and answers. Let me read you four of these questions and the answers from the 1806 catechism to be used throughout the Empire of France. 1. What are the duties of all Christians toward the emperor? Answer. All right, children, now memorize this. Christians owe to the princes who govern them, and we owe in a special manner to our Emperor Napoleon I, love, reverence, obedience, loyalty, military service, and the taxes imposed for the preservation of his empire and of his throne. All right, children, now what's the next question? Why are we obliged to perform our duties to the emperor? Shall the children answer and recite? Because God, who raises up empires and distributes them as He wills, by heaping favors upon our emperor in peace and war, has set him up as our sovereign and made him minister of His, capital His, power and His, capital H, image on earth. To honor and serve our emperor is therefore to honor and serve God himself. Thank you, children. Next question. How should we regard those who fail to perform their duty to our emperor? Answer. According to the apostles, St. Paul, they resist the order established by God and deserve eternal damnation. How about that, children? If you fail to perform your duty to our emperor, you deserve eternal damnation. Yes, teacher. Question. Will the duties which we owe to our emperor be also binding with regard to his lawful successors? The children answer. Yes, without any doubt, because we read in the sacred scripture that God, the Lord of heaven and earth, by an order of his supreme will and by his providence, gives empires not only to one person in particular, but also to his family. If you'll note what this means, Napoleon's wife, Josephine, and all the subsequent generations of his families are given the empire by God. And it says so in the French Catholic Church Catechism. When he did die, there was a question with revolutionary France holding Rome under its control. Would there any longer be a pope? Napoleon never tried to abolish the pope, just to imprison him and torture him, getting the pope to say what Napoleon wanted him to say and to think what Napoleon wanted him to think. So the question was, after Napoleon died, with Catholicism, and would Rome as its capital be abolished? With the radical vision of the last king being strangled by the guts of the last priest, now happened as the last sad chapter in the French Revolution. Everybody was holding their breath, but that's not what happened. Christ was with the church, and the papacy survived, as we know. There are three reasons. The first was that the Italian Catholic loyalists rose up against the French. The second was the Austrians, who provided a militarily defensible haven for the election of the popes, for instance, for Pope Pius VII in Venice. The third reason was that the French now recognized Napoleon as their first consul, and the first consul had no interest in ridding the world of Catholicism or deposing the pope. He merely wanted, at least for starters, to recover his Italian conquests from the Austrians. He said, "I am sure that the Catholic religion is the only religion that can make a stable community happy and establish the foundations of good government. I undertake to defend it always. I intend that the Roman Catholic religion shall be practiced openly and in all its fullness." France, who had been through this terrible atheist revolution, had had her eyes open through tremendous suffering and had seen that the Catholic religion was the single anchor on reality that preserved France. That was the Catholic Church. Nothing else held it all together. On another occasion, Napoleon said, "Tell the Pope that I want to make him a present of 300 million Frenchmen." So Pope Pius VII thought he could strike an accord with the First Council, Napoleon. Well, it wasn't quite that, was it? Napoleon wanted to run the Catholic Church. As we saw a moment ago, he even made his own additions to the French catechism that was taught to children in the schools. Napoleon did restore religious education for children, allotted seminaries to the church, and went beyond the terms in Concordat to maintain church-state amity. The Pope even agreed to crown him. It took place at the Cathedral of Notre Dame, with Napoleon crowning himself and his queen in the presence of the Pope, who had refused at the last minute to place the crown on his head. But the popular acclamations, applause, and support that greeted the Pope were noticed by Napoleon, and he realized he had something of a rival. Then Napoleon's rule became despotic, sometimes enlightened, but mostly not. Instead of revolutionary terror, he relied on secret police. He asserted imperial authority over church appointments, teaching, and other matters, and he imprisoned priests, bishops, and cardinals who did nothing but annoy him. He was on a perpetual campaign of defeating every continental army in Europe. During his time as emperor, he led the Catholic Church on a merry chase, or pulled it on a merry chase, and drugged Pope Pius VII to Paris. I've covered that in another program. Almost killed him in the trip, basically arrested him and brought him to Paris. When he was crowned emperor, he wanted the Pope to do the crowning. He didn't quite get his wish. He had to put the crown on his own head and on the Empress Josephine's head. The Pope was his prisoner, but they bargained with each other. They were both excellent diplomats. They had concordance and agreements, and both sides made concessions. They actually liked each other. You are both very cultured, intelligent men. But this does not mean that Pope approved of Napoleon. Far from it. Earlier, the Pope had refused to declare war on all the enemies of France. And that had been the last straw for Napoleon. And he seized the Pope, declared war on Rome, invaded it. To get the Pope back to France, he wanted to bring him to the Fontainebleau, where he could watch him and control him. Well, the Pope was his prisoner. So what he did is dressed him as a priest so nobody would recognize him on the journey. Napoleon wanted to control all the information about everything, of course. The Pope was suffering from a terrible intestinal pain and blockage for this period, and so it was a rough carriage ride. They would only move at night. Napoleon wanted no one to recognize the Pope. And, of course, the journey took a couple of weeks, and the Pope was nearly dead when he got to Fontainebleau. Pope Pius VII and Napoleon debated each other for more than a decade. They enjoyed debating each other. Now, Pius VII had been a monk and maintained a monk's humility and piety. But he also proved politically astute and recognized that the papacy must and could swim in the new political waters of Europe. Though vastly different men, Pius VII and Napoleon I would cooperate after many tempestuous arguments to actually restore the religious, if not the temporal, peace of France. The two men did sign a concordat, 1801, and the Pope's power to depose bishops was recognized. This was a necessity. The Pope had to heal the breach between clerics who had given their allegiance to the Republic and those who had given their allegiance to Rome. Napoleon had later thoughts. He wanted to restrict this new reassertion of papal power. So he published a list of organic articles to the Concordat the following year. These articles reaffirmed Gallicanism, that is, the superiority of civil to religious law, and the legality of the state seizure of church property. But on the other hand, it recognized Catholicism as the majority religion in France, but not the only religion, and made Catholic clerics state employees. Still, given the furnace of atheism, anarchy, and state-enforced New Agery through which the French Church had just passed, this was a remarkable victory for the Church and for the Pope, the faith of the apostles, and the Catholic foundations of Europe. The left in France recognized what had happened and was appalled. If France must have a religion, they wanted a Protestant France with married priests, minimal doctrine, little authority.
Instead, what happened? The old religion returned. Not only that, it triumphantly returned. It returned on a wave of popularity and support of the common people. Not only that, it returned because of its attraction for Napoleon himself. The poor left wing. The left thought they had found a great leader, Napoleon, in their war on the church. Napoleon restored religious education for children, allotted seminaries to the church. He went beyond the terms of the agreement because these two men had instituted a new relationship between church and state, a vibrant relationship. Well, what do you know? You never know what's going to happen, do you? Well, we're going to take a break. And I'm sorry I won't be with you during this break, but God will.